for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu criticizes the U.S. over a possible nuclear deal with Iran. Thousands in Russia mourn a slain opposition leader. And the Venezuelan president calls for a sharp reduction in staff at the American Embassy in Caracas. Here for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of El País, Kim Katas of the BBC, and Yoki Driesen of Foreign Policy. Your calls, your comments are always an important part of our program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Thanks, Dan.
Good morning, Hi. Diane.
Good to see you. Yoki Driesen, what effect, if any, do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech before the Congress will have in regard to the U.S. and Iran and their negotiations?
So watching the speech, I thought that somebody who was watching it from another planet would think, what a popular American president that is. The English is fluent, the idiom was fluent, the applause lines were fluent, he knew just how to wave to the crowd. The speech was obviously to a room that was predisposed to be friendly. It had either the more hawkish Democrats, the Democrats who felt like they couldn't skip it, like Nancy Pelosi, and Republicans, and empty seats among the Democrats who boycotted were filled by other Republicans. So it was a friendly audience. That said, I thought he did two things that were very smart and that will have an impact. He posed two questions to the White House, and they have not yet responded to either, and at some point they're going to have to. One is, he began with a long litany of past Iranian sins and evil acts as we would see them against the U.S., deaths of Marines, attacks against Jewish targets around the world. So that question posed to the White House is not should you have this particular deal, but should you have any deal with a country that hasn't potentially changed. The second was, he raised legitimate questions. I mean, if you have a 10-year sunset period, which was his major concern that 10 years in, all sanctions are lifted and potentially Iran goes right back to its nuclear program, that is a legitimate question. People can disagree. The White House would disagree. But at some point, they have to answer that in a way other than just sort of glibly saying there was nothing new. There was something new. It was a case coming from an ally, respected on the Hill, making a serious, legitimate charge. And the White House at some certain point has to respond to it. One last point. There's legislation on the Hill that people thought this was him lobbying for, the Kirk-Menendez bill, which would slap more sanctions on Iran immediately if the talks fell through. That's actually not the game he was playing. He was playing the longer game, because the longer game is, if there is a deal, at some point Congress has to vote to lift all sanctions. That can't happen without Congress. That's going to be very hard when you have a GOP Senate and a GOP House, but that's the fight. Kirk Menendez is a sideshow. The fight ultimately is, will Congress vote to do that or not?
Kim, how did you see it?
I thought it was a very smart speech. There were none of the theatrics that the Israeli Prime Minister has used in some of his past speeches, like at the UN with a little, you know, drawing of a bomb and a red line. It was a smart speech addressed to an audience which, as Yochi mentioned, was friendly, but he made some very valid points. And of course he has his critics, but if you look at what he tried to do, he tried, as Yochi said, to appeal to a deep-seated sense of mistrust that people have in the U.S. towards Iran. He started not by talking about the Iran nuclear deal. He started by talking about the history of, you know, let's say, as he sees it, nefarious Iranian conduct in the Middle East, practically telling Americans, don't forget, Iran has been your enemy for a long time. And it's this play on emotions, I think, that was quite smart. And I agree with Yochi as well that the onus now is really on the Obama administration to do a better job trying to sell the deal, trying to get to a good deal, trying to reassure Sunni allies in the region, which silently and tacitly probably approved of Mr. Netanyahu's concerns because they have some of the same. But also, finally, I think that what the administration is perhaps missing, and you get to hear that a lot if you talk to people in the region, is that they think they can compartmentalize their negotiations with Iran. They think they can only stick to a nuclear deal. And I think they fail to see that for the Iranians, it is part of a bigger game. It is part of their role, how they situate themselves in the region. And you cannot isolate the two. And this is what the administration is trying to do.
Moises.
I agree that it was a great speech, a well-crafted, smart speech, and well-delivered. The points that need to be stressed, however, is that the alternative to a no deal is not clear. If there is no deal with Iran on its program, what happens? And that continues to be the big question that neither Bibi Netanyahu nor the Republicans have answered. And it's a critical issue. And it's also, of course, contingent of what kind of deal will eventually be agreed or presented. The second very important point is that needs to be emphasized is that some critics have said that this was just a campaign stop that Bibi Netanyahu made just weeks before a highly contested election in Israel.
So how was the speech received in Israel?
Well, the polls moved a little bit in favor of Bibi Netanyahu, but it was not a significant change. And the voters have been highly volatile. As you know, the political system in Israel is highly fragmented. In order to govern, you have to assemble a coalition made very often of very uncomfortable partners. And Bibi Netanyahu by now is a highly experienced crafter of these complicated coalitions that allow him to be in government. But the central point is what is the alternative to a no deal, and how much of this speech was a part of an electoral campaign taking place 6,000 miles away from the U.S. Congress?
Yeah, I think Mr. Netanyahu didn't do enough to show what the alternative is. And you know, Yochi wrote a great piece about how Mr. Netanyahu did to some extent signal that he could now live kind of with a deal, which we haven't really heard from him before. I don't want to steal your thunder, but I am promoting your writing.
Thank you.
But it's not enough. And we heard from the American Secretary of State saying that simply asking the Iranians to capitulate, that's not the solution. But it's also important to remember that Iran has its own domestic politics. They're also watching what's going on. Some of the more moderates feel that the speech was playing, Mr. Netanyahu's speech was playing in the hands of the hardliners in Iran, undermining the case that the reformers or the more moderates are trying to make in favor of a deal. And as the president said, in the end, Mr. Netanyahu was speaking as though a deal had already been struck when it hasn't. And we're not there yet. There is still time before, and a lot of hurdles before we actually get to a deal. And we always think that the Americans are the toughest when it comes to the negotiations, when in fact, I actually think it's the French who are tougher on the Iranians. And they have a lot of qualms about some of what they see, some of the concessions that are being made.
And, of course, it's fascinating that even as Netanyahu was speaking, Secretary of State Kerry was meeting with the Iranians on this deal. One last question, Yochi. The PLO voted to suspend all security cooperation with Israel. What does this mean?
It's potentially a very big deal. It's in that category of things that slip into the slipstream of other bigger stories, but it's hard to believe that will actually take place, frankly, because that would be a full rupture with Israel. One of the last areas in which Israel and the Palestinians have any cooperation that's effective or civil is on the security front. When Kerry had his peace team, John Allen, the retired general who's now the main envoy for the fight against the Islamic State, all he did was try to get better ties on the security front between Israel and the Palestinians. The West Bank has been quiet. Gaza, under the control of Hamas, is not. So if this actually happens, and I doubt that it will, but if it actually happens and that cooperation stops, that's a huge setback for the U.S. It's one of the few accomplishments of the Kerry peace team disappears. It also means you could have some form of violence akin to what you're having now in Gaza, also in the West Bank, which would be catastrophic.
Now, this week you also found that tensions between Iraq and the U.S. are growing over how to battle ISIS. What's going on, Kim?
Well, how to unpick the mess in the Middle East. Always a challenge. Where to start? Well, there is an offensive that is underway to retake Tikrit, hometown of Saddam Hussein, from ISIS. It is a combined effort between Iraqi forces and Shia militias that are obviously backed by Iran. So it makes for strange bedfellows because Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC, the Republican Guards, is reportedly on the ground in Iraq, and the Pentagon is nowhere to be seen. And this Iraqi army is supposed to be allied with the U.S. So in a way, the Iranians are doing some of the work that the Americans would want to see happen, but that raises a lot of questions about what happens after Tikrit is potentially retaken.
So clearly, the U.S. strategy for combating ISIS seems to be changing somewhat. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk further about Mosul and then move on to Russia. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the financial services firm of Raymond James, for over 50 years offering wealth management, banking, and capital markets expertise with a focus on putting the client's financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And from Constant Contact, providing small businesses and nonprofits email and online marketing tools to engage customers and connect with new ones, for sending newsletters, promoting events, and tracking results. More at ConstantContact.com.
And welcome back. Moises Naim of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and chief international columnist for El País is here. So is Kim Kattas, State Department correspondent for the BBC and author of The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power, and Yogi Driessen, managing editor for News at Foreign Policy and author of the book, The Invisible Front. Kim, just before the break, we were talking about the U.S. role in trying to regain Tikrit and the strange bedfellows that are now operating there, Iraq and Iran.
Absolutely. I think it's an unfolding situation where suddenly the Americans and the Iranians are very strange bedfellows. They are undeclared allies, if you will.
In
that fight against ISIS. But it raises a lot of questions, because how do you undermine ISIS, which is raising the flag of, you know, the battle for Sunnis, the suddenly the Sunnis feel downtrodden and they're raising that flag. How do you undermine their message if at the forefront of the fight against ISIS are Shia militias? That is not going to work. What happens the day after Tikrit is retaken? Will Sunnis feel safe, or will Shia militias go on a rampage? And how does that, what does that mean for the potential battle for Mosul? You know, Sunnis want to reclaim their cities, but they want to know how it's going to happen and what is going to happen the day after.
Moises.
And this, one of the underlying central themes here is the America's decisions about no boots on the ground. So the fact that the United States has decided or feels constrained to send troops in Iraq and fight ISIS means that the U.S. has outsourced that part of the war to Iran. It is important to note that the general that was mentioned here, General Qasem Soleimani, who is the Iranian head of the long-term serving, almost legendary head of the Quds Force, was a declared enemy. The United States intelligence services and the United States have for many years gone after him, and now I'm sure they are synchronizing, coordinating, and collaborating with him in fighting ISIS.
Indirectly,
yeah. I'm sure there's no direct negotiations, but he is part of the story, and I just want to stress that he is a legendary figure in the Middle East and in Iran.
And meanwhile, there are reports today that ISIS has again targeted treasures in the Middle East.
Some of the images that came out this past week were very painful on a personal level. I had spent many months in Mosul when I was living in Iraq. It's a beautiful city. It's absolutely beautiful. There's a river going through it that has Crusader ruins on one side and other ruins on the other. It looks nothing like Baghdad. So for people who envision it as just another dusty brown city, it's not. It's green and it's lush. I was to the museum where the stuff was broken. I've been to the gates that were shattered. Those were the pride of the city, those gates. In all the fighting that took place in the north between Saddam and the Kurds, those were never touched. And so to see those being not only destroyed but gleefully destroyed was heartbreaking.
Why were they destroyed?
Because they were seen as either idols or just as having predated the Prophet and predated Islam, and as a result, by definition, just being blasphemous. Yeah. The human toll, of course, dwarfs the toll of any antiquity, but all the same, it's a return to medieval times in every way impossible in terms of the law imposed, in terms of the destruction of artwork, in terms of the types of deaths and killings that are used, crucifixions being burned alive. I mean, these are things that are in a very literal sense drawn from the 7th century. Just a very quick point, I thought Kim's analysis was exactly right. In the Netanyahu speech, he had a very smart zinger, I think. He talked about how in the fight against ISIS, talking about Iran, the enemy of your enemy is still your enemy. So trying to make the case that even if right now it's a useful alliance, not to forget that it's still, as Moises talked about, a man who has American blood on his hands, a force, the Quds force with American blood on its hands, and not to forget that that's the history behind all of this.
Moises.
I wanted to mention another surprising development related to ISIS, and that is the consequences of plummeting oil prices in their capacity to operate and finance themselves. They have been hit by sanctions and by all kinds of attempts at restricting, you know, the follow the money approach to fighting terrorism, is try to get at their sources of funding and hurt them there. But now there is another dimension to this, and that ISIS was depending quite significantly on oil that they were had taken over in the fields, in the oil-producing fields in Syria and elsewhere. Well, that oil now is worth much less. And so what we have heard is all kinds of restrictions and you know, fiscal adjustments, if you will, that ISIS has to undertake. It's paying less. It's delaying payments to their troops and has less money to govern. And remember, for ISIS, it's very important to control territory. Mm-hmm. Part of who they are and what they claim, and the caliphate needs to have the control of the territory. Well, that comes with a price tag.
So where are they getting their current monies? They were getting it from kidnappings and the like, as well as oil.
Well, now that has to increase. Now all kinds of illicit activities and smuggling and kidnappings and extortions and looting is now far more important.
Taxation.
And that's far more important because has become more important as a result of dropping oil prices.
Indeed.
And don't forget private donors. private donors. You know, I don't want to overestimate the importance of ISIS, but we shouldn't underestimate it either. And we shouldn't underestimate the fact that it does appeal to many Sunni Muslims. Just want to go back to the point that Yochi was discussing. You know, the part of what we're seeing is an attempt when they destroy statues in museums, or they destroy, they bulldoze the city of Nimrud. When you destroy the past, you control the future. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to change people's psyche. They're trying to change the social fabric, whether it's in Iraq or whether it's in Syria. And the longer they're allowed to hold on to territory, the deeper these changes will be, because they can reach, you know, children and younger generations. But I want to make one bigger point and leave us on that. You know, for the US, ISIS is an Iraq problem. For the Europeans, it's a Syria problem. If you push ISIS out of Iraq and they end up in Syria, what then? The US has no strategy at the moment for Syria. And the Europeans and even the Kurds and various other people are very worried about what happens then. Because again, there, ISIS is advertising itself as the defender of the Sunnis, who have suffered tremendously under the rule of President Bashar al-Assad, an ally of Iran. And that is what is feeding their rank. So at some point, there needs to be a bigger question addressed. What beyond fighting ISIS just from the air?
All right, let's move on to Russia, where thousands of people marched in the street after a prominent Russian opposition leader was gunned down late last week. What happened, Moises?
Boris Nemtsov is an opposition leader and a former deputy prime minister. It was in 1997 under President Yeltsin. He was walking with his girlfriend, very close to the Kremlin, when an assailant just came out of a stairwell behind them and shot him at least four times in the back. Then the attacker jumped into a white car and escaped. And then from then on, there is a lot of debate about who did it and why and who benefits from this. Putin immediately issued, condolences for the family and all that. But this is part of a wave of intimidation against the opposition in trying to create, all kinds of limits.
How prominent was he in the opposition? Wasn't there a letter he was getting ready to send?
He has been one of the most strident critics against President Putin. He just recently mentioned that he thought that Putin was a totally amoral human being and that Putin was more dangerous than the Soviets. So that's the extreme of which he got and he thought of Putin. He was significant in the opposition, but as we know, the Russian opposition is also fragmented and has different factions. It remains to be seen. Putin has ordered, of course, an immediate investigation, and the notion is that that there is a nationalist strain of politics there that is quite violent, and that may be one of the suspects. But he was about to release a report about how Putin actually and the Russian government was deeply involved in the attacks and the war in Ukraine,
and
far more than what it has been acknowledged by the government.
Actually, sending arms and making sure that battle in Ukraine continues.
When Putin talked about how he would find the real killer, it reminded me of O.J. Simpson saying he would find the real killer. I mean, it's absurd. This was within sight of the Kremlin, one of the most secure parts of Russia. There are security cameras everywhere. No one saw anything. The mother of Boris Nemtsov's girlfriend went on to Russian state television to say that her daughter, who was traumatized, saw nothing, which reminds you of kind of in mafia movies where the witnesses all suddenly shut up for fear that they themselves will be killed. His apartment was looted. Some of his computers were stolen. And among the things believed to be taken are drafts of a report that would have said Putin had not only funneled arms, which we know of, but directly ordered both special operations units and also conventional army units. Nemtsov had done something interesting, which is probably what led to his death. He was one of the few who was willing to criticize Putin directly and by name. A lot of the other Russian opposition figures criticized the system. They deliberately try not to mention Putin. They'll mention the oligarchs, his allies, the system. They'll use euphemisms. He went after Putin directly, which was something few others did. I heard a friend of his interviewed who made what I thought was a very interesting point, that she had said to him before he was killed, "Do you feel in danger?" And he said, "I feel safe in part because they know I was part of the former government. At some point, they will be out of government," referring to Putin. That might be optimistic, but that they don't want to set a precedent in which, when they're out of power, the next government comes after them. And that he thought that's what would potentially keep him safe, and of course, tragically, was wrong.
So interesting that the Russian populace has come out by the thousands, Kim, to protest this killing.
Yes, absolutely, because I think that this killing shocked even those who had lost the ability to be shocked anymore. It feeds deep fears of a new wave of repression. There was a very powerful piece by Garry Kasparov, also Russian dissident, former world chess champion, in The Guardian today, saying, you know, the time for appeasement is over. He sees the Western policy towards Russia, particularly the EU, but also the US, as appeasement. And he said, you know, there is a reason why so many people came out onto the street. You know, don't just look at the approval poll ratings of Putin, but look at the people who are on the street. They also deserve to be given a different choice than Putin or nothing.
And meanwhile, the EU is warning of new sanctions if there's a serious violation of the Ukraine ceasefire. Hasn't there already been?
Multiple. I mean, the current one. You know,
exactly.
The violence is held at a low level briefly. But again, Putin has shown himself repeatedly willing to take what the West throws at him, basically laugh, and then wait for the next wave that he could laugh at a second time.
Yoki Driesen of Foreign Policy, author of the book The Invisible Front, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of callers. I want to open the phones. We'll talk more about some of our other topics, but let's hear what listeners have to say first to Kate in Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much, Diane. I've been listening to you for more than 30 years.
Oh,
so
thank
I'm a bit
you.
Of a fan. I have a comment and a question for your panel, and they always impress me, your panel. I was very offended this week by Netanyahu's visit and the invitation to him. But I feel it's very difficult in our country. For one thing, the Senate and the Congress seems to be, you know, trying to outdo itself on who can love Israel more. And I feel it's very difficult for Americans to speak out against what Israel does. Just because a person speaks out against Israel and their policies doesn't mean that we don't love Israel. There are many people abroad who don't love all American policies. They still love America. And I feel that when you try to say these things in public, one is perceived as being anti-Semitic, which we don't feel that we are. We just don't like all the policies that Israel proceeds with. But my question to your panel is, what do you think, how do you think Mr. Netanyahu, not the country of Israel, but Mr. Netanyahu, would have responded? How would he have felt if President Obama came over to Israel and attacked their government for all these settlements that many Americans don't approve of? What would his reaction have been, in your opinion?
Moises.
That's a great question, and I think President Obama sort of answered that question. He just said, as in reaction to the whole thing, he just mentioned, you know, how would have you felt if during President George W. Bush's administration, President Chirac of France would have been invited to the U.S. Congress to criticize the war on Iraq. without coordinating with the White House and without really working in a collaborative way. And I think the same thing applies here. You can also imagine the opposition in France inviting President Obama to address the National Assembly to criticize an initiative of President Hollande. How would the French feel about that? So this is just one more example of the extreme polarization that is creating all kinds of surprising and unwelcome situations in today's politics here.
I thought it was a very smart comment and a very smart question. Two quick points. One, virtually every American official who does go to Israel to address any gathering of Israelis does condemn the settlement policy. So that message is conveyed pretty directly. But I think she hit on something that was important. The level of vitriol and the words used by Democrats was very striking. He was called condescending, insulting to the U.S., taking a page from the Dick Cheney playbook. You don't hear that usually about an Israeli leader.
All right, short break here, more of your calls when we come back. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Citrix with GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring HD video conferencing, screen sharing, and meeting recording capabilities. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. From the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. More information is available at wallacefoundation.org.
Saturday marks the 50th anniversary of the first voting rights march from Selma to Montgomery. On the next Fresh Air, archive interviews with civil rights lawyer J.L. Chestnut, who witnessed the police attack marchers, Senator John Lewis, a leader of the march.
I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. I thought I was going to die.
And Ava DuVernay, director of the film Selma, join us.
And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. Let's move to another part of the world, to Venezuela. Moises, President Nicolas Maduro has repeatedly accused the United States of supporting a plot to overthrow him. Now he says, you in Venezuela have to reduce the size of your embassy to the equivalent size of our embassy in Washington, which apparently numbers 17. Is that correct?
Yes. And the U.S. Embassy Caracas is about 100.
That's what I thought.
So it's essentially, and they have been given 15 days to withdraw 83.
Why is
this
he
is
so?
This is just part of a longstanding strategy by President Maduro and the government to denounce foreign conspiracies abroad and at home, and often together, to try to unseat him and undermine their revolution. And you know, coexist at the same time, this is happening in a country that is going through one of the most terrible economic situations in the world. The Economist magazine just issued a ranking that indicated that Venezuela has the worst indicators. It was the worst economy in the world in terms of unemployment, shortages of all kinds
and
of basic
necessities. What's happened to that economy?
Well, let's remember that Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world.
Exactly.
And it's a very wealthy country. But since President Chavez, and then continued with a vengeance by President Maduro, there is a whole set of economic policies that did not stimulate investment, did not stimulate job creation that is sustainable and not subsidized. And the economy is in shambles. They managed to destroy what was one of the wealthiest economies.
So he's looking to blame.
He is using the old trick of blaming others and finding conspiracies and denouncing and accusing people outside the country and inside. And, you know, he just jailed the leaders of the opposition. A large number of mayors of cities that were elected, that are members of the opposition, have judicial, you know, have been accused of, and some are in jail. And he has thrown in jail the mayor of Caracas. So there is a lot of using the courts to persecute the opposition and dissidents. Then there is very brutal repression by the police and the security forces. And meanwhile, the economy is just spiraling out of control.
But how much support does he have? I realize he has control. But what about among the people? Does he have support?
It's always hard to tell exactly how much support someone has in a country like this because, you know, remember that President Mubarak in Egypt was being reelected with 98% of the votes, and clearly it turned out that he didn't have the support of 98% of the people. I think President Maduro's approval ratings are going down, including because of the very difficult social conditions, the worsening economic situation. Venezuela is in the top five of Bloomberg's index of the most painful economies in the world. It's not getting any better with the drop in oil prices. And also remember, you know, this whole visa thing or this embassy thing, you know, downsizing the number of staff at the American embassy. You know, the biggest impact it's going to have, it's going to be on Venezuelans who are trying to apply for visas to come to the U.S. In 2014, there were 232,000 applications. Can you imagine 17 people now having to process the same number of applications? So
and
clearly people are looking for ways to leave the country in one way or another.
And he is also creating a list of former and current American officials who he alleges are guilty of terrorism against Syria and Iraq, and he wants to bar them from visiting Venezuela. I'm sure President George W. Bush, former Vice President Dick Cheney, and others would just as soon not go.
Right. And for many of them, it's a chance to say, as Bob Menendez, the Democrat from New Jersey, is one of them who said this, that it's a badge of pride that when a country is corrupt, led by a leader that they see as so corrupt and ineffective, says you're not welcome, that means you're doing something right. It's interesting. Two of the countries that have been hit hardest by both the oil collapse and also by sanctions have been Iran and Russia. Both of them have been able to withstand them in part because there's a fierce nationalism in both countries, a fierce willingness to say to the West, we'll take everything you can do to us and we'll still survive. Putin's very effective at that in Russia, the mullahs and the other leaders of Iran and Tehran. Venezuela doesn't have that. I mean, part of the way that Chavez governed was explicitly through class warfare, explicitly through fracturing his society, so you don't have that same sort of nationalistic fervor to withstand economic pain that you do in other countries.
All right, let's go to Richard in Fort Myers, Florida. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Diane.
Hi.
I have a rather long, but now I think it's kind of brief, but a question regarding Putin and his ability to baffle and keep the other countries on edge about what he's going to do next. The ball needs to be put in our court as far as what we're going to do to, I guess, respond to his what he's doing in Ukraine and other places. He's been an assassin since he was probably in the KGB. There have been numerous assassinations that have been attributed to him, including in Britain and other countries. And the question whether or not we can do anything about it is astounding.
Good question.
And European countries are increasingly concerned about the belligerence, Putin's belligerence, and his willingness, and apparently to do whatever he wants. The Deputy Secretary General of NATO, who is a U.S., he's a top civilian official. His name is Alexander Virchow. Just said yesterday that an angry revisionist Russia is redrawing the borders by force, and that is unacceptable. And he says Putin's aim is to turn Ukraine into a failed state and to suppress and alter alternative voices in Russia so as to prevent a Russian Maidan. And I think that's a very important point. The Maidan, as we recall, was the protests in Ukraine that took down the President Viktor Yanukovych, who was a puppet of Moscow. And so there is a lot of concern that Putin is picking fights abroad in order to distract from economic troubles at home.
I want to ask you about Argentina, Yoki. There is new information about the death of Alberto Nisman, the Argentine prosecutor. It has been, at first, talked of as a suicide. There are real questions there.
Yeah, the cliche about Hollywood couldn't make this up, which we've all used since the story first broke, we could just use again and again and again. So first we had a man in a locked bathroom shooting himself potentially in the back of the head, which is a kind of remarkable accomplishment of, you know, physical dexterity. Then you had accusations later proved correct that he was working on an indictment of the president of Argentina for what would be a really historic kind of cover-up of saying to a country that had carried out, Iran, the deadliest terror attack in her country in its history, we'll try to cover it up so we can have better trade relations. You've now had the government of Argentina leak out rumors that he was involved in some weird sexual relationships, rumors that he was a drug addict, rumors that he was an alcoholic. You had this amazing thing this week where, again, the government of Argentina, this is not an outside group, but the actual government of Argentina bought a full-page ad denouncing Nisman. So you have this incredible dynamic of nobody, I think, with a right mind believes that this man just happened to shoot himself the day before he'd indict the president. But you have that case, the future of that case being in doubt. You have the government of the country taking out an ad bashing him. And the newest bit, and you sort of reference this in the question, his family, more specifically his ex-wife, who is herself a judge in Argentina, put out a report, or more accurately, did a press conference summarizing what they said were the findings of an independent study, autopsy they had carried out of his death, in which they said bluntly he was murdered. And some of the evidence they pointed to were there was no gunpowder residue on his hands, that there was no alcohol in his system, that the government at one point had said maybe he had an involuntary spasm, that there was no evidence of a spasm. So they put out what seemed like a fairly detailed dossier saying he could not have killed himself, to which the government basically responded by saying, we're going to put out an ad denouncing this dead man yet again.
Just to be clear, it was the day before he was to testify to lawmakers that President Cristina Fernandez orchestrated a secret deal with Iran to hide the role of Iranian officials alleged to be responsible for the 1994 bombing of a Jewish community center where 85 people died. Fernandez and Iran have certainly denied those allegations.
Argentina has a long history of having highly corrupt governments, but no other government in Argentina has come close to the level of corruption that presided Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. It's an extremely corrupt government. And in a poll done in January after the death of Nisman, it found that 70% of Argentines believe that Nisman was murdered. 82% of Argentinians found credible his accusations that President Fernandez de Kirchner was somehow involved in a shady deal with the Iranians and was trading oil for shielding the Iranians that have been accused of masterminding and executing the bombing in 1994. So then what we're seeing now is a battle between different factions of the judiciary. The judiciary in Argentina is also highly corrupt. It has different factions. The government controls many of those, but there are some others. And the secret services in Argentina have also been involved, and they're fragmented. President Cristina Kirchner fired one of the leaders of this intelligence services. So it is, as Yoki said, this is, you know, Hollywood could not have developed a more complicated, incredible plot than what we're witnessing. But underlying this is a huge tragedy where a country that is wealthy, that is culture, that has great education, culture, and all kinds of positive traits is declining year after year.
You know, we have an expression in Lebanon, in Arabic, but I'll translate it, when dissidents or people who are onto something die in mysterious circumstances and the authorities say that it was a suicide, we say he was suicided. This, you know, as Yochi pointed out, the report that came out makes very clear that this was homicide. But the whole affair also ties back to the discussion we were having at the beginning of the show, which is Iran's role. Because Iran's fingerprints, you know, are alleged to be on this bombing. Hezbollah is also connected to it. Hezbollah's a Shiite militia, a political group in Lebanon that is very much backed by Iran. And that goes to the point that we were making about this nuclear deal that is being negotiated with Iran needs to be seen in the wider context of what kind of relationship the U.S. wants to have with Iran and how that affects its alliance with Sunni countries in the region.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Joe in Lansing, Michigan. You're on the air. Joe, are you there? Okay, let's go to Bradley in Morehead City, North Carolina. Are you there?
I'm here, Diane. Thank you. A comment, perhaps, watching body language and such. At the Winter Olympics in Russia, I never saw Putin smile one time.
Well, who knows whether he was happy for all the money they spent on those Olympics.
For hotels, they'll never be used again.
Exactly.
I mean, one point worth mentioning, just to an earlier point about Ukraine, Putin wants it more. I mean, that's just the reality of why he's willing to do what he's doing and accepting the pain he's accepting. The West is not going to go to war for Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It might go to war for a NATO nation. It will not go to war for Ukraine. Putin will.
All right. And to John in Indianapolis, you're on the air.
Thanks, Diane. Listen to your show often.
Thank you.
I have two quick questions. One is, I understand that there are five countries involved in the negotiations with Iran, and I was wondering if Netanyahu plans to visit the other four and speak to their assemblies and parliaments. Secondly, it seems to me that our foreign policy in the Middle East has been dictated to a large extent by oil and Israel. Is it time we cut loose from both of those dependencies and not allow ourselves to be victims of their policies?
The opposition in these other four countries has not invited Mr. Netanyahu to address the National Assembly or Congress, and therefore it's very unlikely that he'll go there. And also now he has to concentrate on the election that it's coming up very soon. And so he's campaigning for that. And like, as I said before, it's very clear that the speech here was a campaign stop also.
One thing that Mr. Netanyahu was trying to do was trying to get Congress to stand with him against a deal and push the idea that in some way, at the end, the deal should be put to a vote in Congress, which is not an idea that is welcomed by the other members of the so-called P5 plus one. You know, I've spoken to diplomats from those countries who say, you know, once we reach a deal with the Iranians, if there is a deal, it's an agreement and we're all on board and we sign it. But we're not going to go back to our respective parliaments to ratify this. And so we're not quite sure why there is a discussion about this going to Congress. And the other point I want to make on, you know, the alliance with Israel and reliance on oil. There is an argument to be made for rebalancing America's position in the Middle East and being a little bit more independent of what Sunni allies want. But the U.S. often lurches from one extreme to the other in its policies, and that's the perception that we have now, that, you know, they're sort of turning their backs to the Sunni monarchies and going in bed with Iranians. It may not be accurate, but it's certainly the perception.
You know, ultimately, it doesn't come to a matter of choice. For this deal to be ratified, for the U.S. to be able to deliver on what Obama is saying he can deliver, it has to go to Congress. The sanctions that are in place can be lifted temporarily. They cannot be lifted permanently, so they have to go to Congress whether they want to or they don't want to.
Yoki Driessen, Foreign Policy, Kim Katasa, the BBC, Moises Naim. He's at the Carnegie Endowment and chief international columnist for El País. Thank you all. Have a good and safe weekend.
And a sunny weekend.
And a sunny weekend.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you,
and thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.